Hello and welcome to the Open Labour podcast. I'm joined today, as always, by my co-host, Tom Hinchcliffe. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
And today is the last of our NEC election specials. And we're being joined by Councillor Alice Perry. Alice is a councillor in Islington and is actually an incumbent member of the National Executive Committee representing local Labour councillors. Alice is also a member of the Local Government Association and is a deputy whip of the LGA Labour Group. Today's interview with Alice is slightly shorter than some of our NEC election specials, so we thought we'd take the opportunity to reintroduce our heroes and villains section. Tom, what do you think? Shall I do the heroes bit and you do the villains bit?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, I mean, we usually do it the other way around, don't we? So, yeah.
Well, why not mix it up a bit?
Let's have some positivity from you for once.
Fantastic. And now we're joined by Alice Perry. Hi, Alice. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. As well as can be expected anyway under the current circumstances. Obviously, we had some bad news yesterday, but okay in the round. Massive congratulations on getting on the ballot already. That's great news. We're really pleased with that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's fantastic to have so many Labour groups nominate me already. So I really appreciate the support, particularly as I know councils are so busy responding to COVID. So the fact that people are taking time out of like the really important, crucial response work to make nominations for the NEC is fantastic.
I was particularly pleased to see Kirk Lees that had nominated you yesterday. I do work for Kirk Lees Council, so that was really positive. I was really pleased. Yeah, we'll jump straight into it, if that's okay. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, about your background.
Thanks. So I'm from London, I'm from the People's Republic of Islington. That's where I grew up. So, Islington's always historically been a very political place and something that I was always around, but I really got active around 2008, but weirdly during the parliamentary expenses scandal, which looking back is quite a weird time to get involved with, but it seemed like people's faith in institutions was really being shaken and Labour were kind of on a downturn and there was a risk that we were going to lose power and be replaced by the Conservative Party, who have such different values. And I felt the values that we hold and things like equality and workers' rights and just the kind of decent society that we had were things that we were taking for granted, and it was about to be torn up by a Conservative government. So
that's really insightful, Alice, actually. I think a lot of people went the other way, didn't they? And think, Labour Party's lost its way, it's lost its values. So I'm going to try alternate forms of protest. So it's really interesting that you actually... Did you join the Labour Party in 2008 or just get more involved?
Yeah, I joined in 2008. So I'd always been active and around the Labour Party, but I hadn't wanted to join when I was a teenager because of party democracy issues, I think. Right. Won't go into the background, but I did feel it wasn't, there was other kinds of activism that were more appealing, but it was in 2008. I remember my dad was delivering leaflets and stuff, and he was off when he's doing it. There was hardly any activists helping, and I was God, we've got to step up if we want to keep this. So that's when I got involved. And then it was the 2010 general election. I was just knocking on doors every day, trying to keep, because Islington South was considered a marginal as well, and I thought it was really important that we kept our MP and fought back again and won back the council and fought back against the Lib Dem council that had very different values. They were spending lots of money, making everything look beautiful and on conservation.
classic Lib Dem cosmetic politics. Yeah, get rid of the children's services and make a street look a bit prettier. Classic.
Shopfront politics.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah, it was classic Lib Demery, where they were spending $100k on a living wall, which looked but you could just grow some ivy down the side and spend that money. Libraries. So that was really winding me up too. And then the Lib Dems were getting really cool with young people, which was really riling me up.
So it's like mania.
Yeah, totally. And I was like, this is so wrong. We've got to like stand up for what we care about. And then like after that, people were like, oh, have you thought about standing to be a councillor? Because you got quite involved in like the local politics too. And like it wasn't really something like I thought about. Like my dad's a councillor, like he's a Labour councillor, first elected in Islington in 1990. So I think he's been a councillor with lots of now like current and former MPs and stuff. And like it wasn't something that I'd thought was for me. But then like there was a by-election in 2011 because the Labour candidate was done for benefits fraud. So that was like quite kind of unique circumstances, and like it had to be a woman standing, and there weren't very many women on the panel of candidates. And like I'd just 6 months before that, I thought maybe I want to stand in 2014. I'll tell you what, I'll stick a form in now and forget about it. But then there was this by-election and people were like, oh, are you gonna go for it? And like without properly thinking it through, I was like, yeah, okay, let's do it.
It sounds like you came into politics at a time of a failing political class everywhere. It's like a culmination of people losing trust in politicians kind of spurred you on to join.
So what year was it? What year did you get elected?
So this is 2011. Yeah. So it's in fact my by-election took place in the middle of the London riots.
Wow.
As well, and like Boris Johnson, the then mayor of London, was one of my local constituents. So that was really weird as well. So before the riots,
did you canvass him?
We did deliver a few leaflets to his house. We did, because I think I won't breach data confidentiality, but like we thought it was worth delivering some things to his house team.
What was he down on the canvassing sheets? As a maybe or?
No, we had him as a guest.
Or UKIP. Did you? Yeah. I'd have him down as UKIP, actually. Yeah, at that time.
Exactly. So, like, it was before the riots that we were campaigning against the cuts they were making to frontline community policing, and they were cutting our local sergeants. So the whole campaign around, like, fighting cuts to police did really resonate with people. And then I was with Claudia Webb, who's now like the MP in Leicester, and at the time she had like a role in like the Metropolitan Police response to like gun crime and stuff. And like we were canvassing one day and she took a phone call, and then she like kind of sat down on the bench, we were nearby, and she's like, oh my god, I'm like, what's happened? And she was taking a call about Mark Duggan being shot by the police. Oh, and then like kind of after that, quite quickly, like things escalated in London, and like the rioting got like, you know, it was like really scary at the time and like quite dramatic. And we were still out canvassing. We had a plan for if they attacked the polling stations and stole ballot boxes, but like rioters weren't like interested in disrupting like the St. Peter's by-election. We kind of like carried on, and people were like, you know, what are you doing out? And yeah, we talked to them about like why it was important and why, you know, it was important to challenge Boris Johnson, and like why he's like, you know, failing as a mayor, and why we need to properly fund our public services and stuff. So yeah, like it was kind of over the summer in like 6 weeks, I was elected as a Labour councillor, and I was like, wow, okay. And like, I think someone said to me at the count, oh, congratulations, you've just put your life in a shredder.
That's one way of putting it.
And like it's quite like a shock first being elected as a councillor, and like it is obviously like an enormous amount of work, but like an amazing honour and privilege as well. So like that was kind of like how I ended up as a councillor. I think the following year as well, I stood for the National Policy Forum. I was like on the CLPD slate for
CLPD. Is that still going back in 2012?
It was, but it wasn't CLPD, tell a lie, it was London Labour Left. Or a bit like the Grassroots Alliance one. So it was like
Vladimir Dera, wasn't it, who set that up? Is that right? Was he still about at that point?
Not that I saw in London. The slate was, it was like quite funny, I found it the other day. Nikki Gavron, me, Alan Orbach and Gary Heather. And like me, Nikki and Alan were elected. So that kind of like...
No John Landsman.
he was attending the meetings and stuff, but he wasn't on the slate that year. Yeah, so it was like that, and that was really interesting, being involved in the MPF actually, and kind of seeing how labour processes worked, and it was something that I was like quite interested in. And then in 2014, like Jim McMahon was standing for the NEC, and like they were looking for like another woman to like stand alongside Jim. And one of the things that like the kind of campaign was about challenging like austerity, but also if Labour were elected in 2015 to kind of like really champion the importance of like ending the cuts to local government and like to, as far as possible, reversing them and highlighting the damage that austerity was doing like across the country. And this is like kind of before like it had been accepted in the party that like now, you know, even the Tories are anti-austerity according to them, but like I think it was like really important to kind of make that case, which like wasn't like universally welcomed by people within the Labour Party as well, but it just like felt like very important and very natural and right to make that case. So did in 2014, not necessarily expecting to win, but like it was a really interesting campaign and talked to lots of different councillors and stuff, and it was like fantastic. Yeah, I won by like maybe like 100 votes or something, and then stood again the following year and ran by like 2,000 votes as well. So that was cool, and like it's been a very eventful and interesting time to be on the NEC from 2014 to now. And I've like always tried to like write NEC reports from all the meetings, so people can kind of keep up to date about like what's going on and stuff. And like there's some really important things you can do on the NEC, like I think championing the role of local government and the contribution councillors make is so important. We contribute loads to the party, and like it's important we get like respect and stuff back.
Yeah, when we're out of government, local councillors are the only way we can change things.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, absolutely. On the NEC, they need to be valued.
Also, there's a lot of important stuff we can do around like increasing diversity of political representation, which is really important, and like encouraging more like women, like black and minority ethnic people, disabled people, LGBT, like working class candidates is really important. So like all parts of society, all different ages and social backgrounds are represented. Like Eric Pickles had this awful like idea that like councillors should just be retired old scoutmasters at the end of their career, and like and there's lots we need to like actually change when we get back into government. Like we need to give councillors back their pensions, because like the kind of lack of pensions and workers' rights and maternity and parental leave is an issue. And like, as I'm like co-chair of the Local Government Association Women's Leadership Task Force, so one of the things we've done is we've written like a model maternity and parental leave policy that we've got around 30 councils to adopt, which is good. But it's, and like, you know, I'm not quite a process person as well, so like I'm quite into like, if you have a good process, you can have a good outcome. So if we can do our selections in the right way and like get like people involved and stuff, we can get good candidates that can lead to us winning elections and stuff.
And it is a base, a launch pad, if you like, for general elections, isn't it? Having good councillors that really make a difference in their communities. People recognise that Labour's active, it's there for them. Or a showcase of Labour Party values that sometimes can be lost in the sort of, in politics it's quite confrontational and all over the place and fast paced in the media. But having Labour councillors doing really good local community work and really serving their communities just demonstrates to people what we stand for and what we're about. And of course, obviously, what local councils are able to achieve as well is another way of showcasing that as well, isn't it? So it is very important. I hope people do recognise the importance of local councillors and get out there and campaign next year for local council elections. That's a plug to all our listeners. I'm up again next year, so I want people out.
It's so important to kind of recognise and understand that, and also not just what we do in power, which is amazing, but like also what we do in opposition, and some of the things that Labour in opposition have been able to achieve is like fantastic. And just thinking the example of like Medway Labour Group as well, of like highlighting, like they've got a really like awful Tory down there, and they were like, there was a car park that was named after a slave trader, and they were like the Tory council that accused them of being a lynch mob because they wanted to name the car park named after a slave trader. It's like, what's wrong with these people? And it's so important to have Labour representatives wherever you're in the country, like holding them to account. Accountability Definitely. And scrutiny is like important, as well as like all the amazing stuff that our councillors are doing like right now in the pandemic as well. So yeah, like, oh, and next year it's a really exciting opportunity with the elections, like, because the Tories deliberately kind of put police and crime commissioner elections and metro mayor elections along with county council elections because it's their strongest cycle, and that's kind of broken next year because so many things are up, and like if you can get turnout up and like get our voters inspired and excited to go out and vote Labour and send a message to this absolutely appalling government, then we can like have a really stunning result. And a lot of Tories then who won their seats last year will like really start thinking, this government, like, you know, if they think they're going to lose their seat in the next election, it might change the dynamics of the government too. So important to send the government a message.
It's about rebuilding that trust, isn't it, as well? And I think obviously Keir is trying his hardest to do that and show the incompetence of the government at the same time. And you're right, if we do, you know, make some relative gains at the locals next year, I think we have to be honest. But if we do, then it really does send a clear message. And I think the government will, or the Tories will, be panicking.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, every day I'm staggered by like just the levels of incompetence and like the lack of empathy the government have as well. They're just so awful. We've got to get rid of these Tories. We've got to get rid of them too.
It's political thuggery, isn't it? I mean, it's incompetence with this kind of brash sense of entitlement that the Tories have always had, but it's never been so pronounced that they're just like this week when they've been saying that they're happy to break international law. That's, you know, as much as that, as I say, the brash sense of entitlement has always been there, it's never been so obvious and so transparent. And I think it's crazy that they think the electorate won't actually care about things like that, even in local elections. It's just not true.
I know, it's like so shocking, and like they're just kind of casual like sexism, homophobia and like racism that's like creeping into like public life because of what the kind of culture they enable as well is like genuinely like quite frightening. So I'm half Australian, so we're not happy. My Australian family about to turn the other thing.
I used to live with in a shared house with somebody from Australia who's a good friend of mine now, and I just sent her a text saying thank you for Tony Abbott, as in a sarcastic text, and honestly the rant I got back from her was like 10 paragraphs of just all the things that he's done when he was prime minister and what a disgusting human being he is. Can I say that? Is that a bit harsh to say? But that's what she said.
I don't think so. No, my family WhatsApp group's been like blowing up when like that happens. They were like, everyone in Australia was just like,
he's truly hated over there, isn't he, by a lot of people.
He's deeply, deeply unpopular. And like, I didn't realise like some of the stuff, which I won't repeat because those are just claims made by like my family members. I don't know if that means they're true, but like some of the stuff, I'm like, God, why would you want this man near your government?
Yeah, crazy. You've already given us some ideas about your priorities if you were to be re-elected to the NEC. Do you want to give us some more specific priorities of yours, please, Alice?
Yeah, so I think it's really important we learn some of the lessons of maybe the mistakes that we've been making in like the more recent past. I think I've been involved in selecting candidates for the snap general elections, like I did the Eastern region in 2017. And like, it was quite bizarre, like someone from the regional board and Pete Wilsman basically selected the candidates off like a list. And like, we had to do that because we didn't have very much time, but it's not really how we should be selecting. No. I think it's so important that like we let members have a like genuine choice of popular local candidates. Sure. And I think like feeling a connection to your candidate like does have an impact in how motivated you feel to campaign as well. So like I think things like that's a real priority, like sorting out the disciplinary and process and complaint system And like, I fully support the move to an independent process where like the perception of political involvement is completely taken out, and like everyone, people who have a complaint made against them or people making a complaint, can feel like just trust in the process, because I think that trust has been fractured. Things are really improving with the complaints process at the moment, and we're like clearing the backlog, and the small panels that we hold do seem to be like working better, but like I feel like there's a lot we need to do to like restore trust in that system, and to like, you know, deal with the problem that we had with anti-Semitism as well, that like,
so what was the problem, without getting too specific, because I don't want to put you on the spot, what do you think were some of the problems then with the complaints procedure? Were they too much red tape, or?
If you're interested, I wrote a Labour-less blog the other day about like basically how it's evolved, and I think it's because it evolved over time. So when we had a smaller membership, we had fewer complaints. Then as the membership grew really rapidly, yeah, we didn't like have the infrastructure growing with it, and with the leadership elections they generated a lot of complaints as well, so that kind of set up a backlog, and then we start to see complaints that we hadn't really seen before. Then you also had the Me Too movement in around 2016 as well, which like meant people from all kinds of public life were like examining behaviors and also coming forward with past like abuses and stuff. So then it became really important to have a robust sexual harassment process, which is better than it was, but like obviously still needs a lot of work, and I think that's why the independent process is very important. It was like, this is something that Bex Bailey had always championed when she was on the NEC, and like it's absolutely awful to hit when like she said about how she'd been raped by someone at the party and then told to cover it up for the sake of her political career. And like I'd seen her like in meetings, and I've seen how passionate she was about it, but I didn't kind of realise her own personal backstory, which I thought was really moving. Mm. At the same time as well, we had like just the rising issue of anti-Semitism as well to deal with. So the process has evolved, and it's been like improving all the time. I think just having the fully independent process, which it is being worked on at the moment, will make people feel a lot more confident, hopefully, in making complaints. Although like it's good to see some like counsellors and people I know who feel like more able to make complaints, and their complaints will be heard and taken seriously. But yeah, like the whole thing like became just such a huge issue in the party as well, and like an issue of like trust and stuff. And I think just having the politics taken out of it has just got to be very healthy.
Yeah, definitely. I think, definitely. Operating on factional lines in a complaints process will never, ever work.
It's madness, isn't it? Madness.
Yeah, but with anti-Semitism and the Me Too movement, obviously it kind of all came at once for the NEC in the complaints process. But as you say, accessibility is key, and that helps generate trust within members, which then generates trust within the electorate, and it's just the right thing to do. So yeah, it's good that that's clearing up now, because that was a bit of a nightmare.
It was like, as part of like the work as well, we had to do like special training. Like I did special training to sit on the sexual harassment like mini panels that we had. And I consider myself someone that knows a lot about equality and like a lot. We had training by someone who does it for like the police and also like universities to try and tackle rape culture on university campuses. And there's stuff like even I like learned and was like kind of shocked about, that actually if you think about how we hold meetings, like a lot of stuff's run by volunteers, and like we need to do more to train and support volunteers to like deal with a lot of this, because you know it can be hard to deal with whether you're having the meetings on person or by Zoom, but like to have that kind of welcoming, inclusive culture in the party where everyone feels they can come and contribute and feel like welcome, whatever their politics and stuff, is really important.
It is clearly quite important that you get re-elected to the NEC, just because you can continue this work you've been doing for a while. I say that with so much bias, but at the same time, you know, that's what we're here for.
I do hope like councillors will re-elect me, and also people will encourage their councillors to re-elect me and their Labour groups to nominate me, because it is like something that I'm really passionate about, and have like given a lot of time to over the last like 6 years. But it's been such a, it's been quite stressful being an NEC member at times, but it's like felt so worthwhile to keep kind of championing what we feel is really important and to like make sure that we're standing up for the values that we care about.
How have you found it working with the new leadership? Without going into Jeremy Corbyn and things like that, just how is it? Is he easy? Is he easy to get on with, Keir? Is he
talking about putting somebody on the spot?
Yeah. He's a very interesting person. So I've known Jeremy since I was like a tiny child. Like I've known Jeremy all my life, and like Jeremy and like dad are friends and stuff. And so it was kind of strange and surreal when Jeremy became leader of the Labour Party, because he's leader of the Labour Party, but he's also Jeremy. And so it meant that like I had a different relationship with him. And it was always nice having that kind of personal friendly relationship with him, even when like meetings might be tense and I might not always voting the way that Jeremy wanted me to vote. So that was a kind of positive. And it was to go from like knowing Jeremy really well to I don't know Keir. And what the one thing that like really struck me about Keir is genuinely he's not factional at all. The NEC is a factional place by like nature, but like Keir really isn't. And like it's very different. Like this has all been denied that like he's the basis for like Mr. Darcy and the Bridget Jones books, and apparently that isn't true. Because he seems like that kind of character. And like, yeah, like he
just. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? That he's like,
it's probably a good thing. Like my sister's like school as well. The kids are like, it's in Chingford in like Ian Duncan Smith's constituency, and all the parents. There's something about that Keir that I just like.
Yeah.
And like, he's very different and he's very grown up. And if you compare him to like, not just Boris Johnson, but like people like David Cameron and stuff, like to have someone very serious.
Yeah.
It's really important.
I think if Keir was elected pre the COVID crisis and the looming sort of Brexit crisis, the Tory attack lines would be, oh, he's boring, he's too sensible, you know, Mr. Boring, the rest of it. You could see the attack lines a million miles away. But I think the country is crying out for somebody that's, you know, it's not like Boris. Boris is all charisma and big tokenistic gestures like going down a zip line or smashing through walls and JCB and the rest of it. You know, what the country's crying out for is somebody that's smart and sensible and can get on with running a country in a way that's in a time of huge crisis. So I think he fits the bill. I mean, I must say that, you know, Open Labour, we supported Lisa Nandy, and Lisa Nandy was who I wanted to be leader. But I'm very comfortable with the way that Keir's performing at the moment. He does seem like a very safe pair of hands, doesn't he?
He's a steady hand, and as you said, the country needs. I'm reluctant to tell the country what it needs. It's on our own podcast, but it needs and wants a steady hand now. And I saw this thing yesterday on Twitter. It was a meme, and it's no drama, just Starmer.
Which is good, although I do think it's important, you know, it's incumbent on us to make sure that there was a lot of very good policies that came out of the Jeremy Corbyn era and certainly in the 2017 and 2019 manifestos. And I think Keir needs to stick to some of those policies, certainly around the Green New Deal and potentially looking at universal basic income and policies like that. So I think it's important that we hold him to account and make sure that he follows those more radical policies as well.
The 2017 manifesto is like really, really special. I'm so proud to be like involved in that. And like, I think it really, like in a really good way, tells the whole story of what Labour's about, what our values are, and like what our vision for the country is. And like criticisms of the 2015 manifesto was it was just too transactional. And like, you vote for us, we'll give you this. But this really did say like what Labour was about and like the difference voting Labour would make. This is a thing we had a discussion with at the NEC, like whether or not the 2017 manifesto really was much better than the 2019 and what the differences between them were, why one was a lot more successful than the other. But I do think in a way that other manifestos haven't, it really did kind of tell that story.
And narrative, yeah.
I know people have said to me that it wasn't a success because it didn't win, but like I think the manifesto itself did really resonate with the public, and like it, I think future manifestos can learn a lot from that particular manifesto in 2017. It just had such great policies inside it as well. Like it's just very sad that we don't get to have those policies. We get to have
maybe eventually. I mean, it's clear that it resonated with the public on a policy basis, because Jeremy was polling so badly personally that it would have been impossible for him to win on personality, or even achieve what he achieved, which was to stop them getting an overall majority. But obviously that completely collapsed last year. So you took part in the standalone NEC meeting, which analysed and evaluated why we lost last year's election. Alice, how did that meeting go? What was the feeling in the virtual room? Was there a consensus at all?
It's an interesting question to ask. So like before the meeting, I didn't really feel that enthusiastic about doing it. It was something we'd all said we wanted to do in the beginning of the year. And like it's obviously something that's so important and vital that we do. But because of COVID, everything had meant that it got delayed. So it was just like, oh God, this again? Oh. But then actually, once we got down to talking about it, it was very positive. And we had like breakout rooms, which is the first time we've done it at an NEC meeting. So like in Zoom, we got all put into like breakout rooms. And actually that worked really, really well. And it meant that people could have like more in-depth discussions. And what we found is like from the discussion group I was in one with like people like, it was me, Michael Wheeler, Laura McNeil, and Anderson, Darren. It's like we had a lot more consensus and a lot more common ground and understanding of like what the challenges were and what we need to do for the future. And we're able to like discuss it in like a much more kind of collaborative, constructive way, and could like really build that kind of common ground, because you miss that when you have Zoom calls. You know, you don't have those chats at lunchtime, or chats in the lift, or like you pass around the sweets to each other and stuff. Like you miss having that. So actually having those smaller discussions was really, really valuable. And it's actually like you can think that like people might have kind of different politics and slightly different views about why things happened, but like people understand what happened and what needs to be done. And like there's no point just raking the coals over like the past and arguing about like what should or could have been. Like it's more like, well, what are we going to do now, because we all do want a Labour government.
It wasn't just like reopening old wounds then, it was actually useful.
Yeah, totally. Like I was worried it would be like just people arguing with each other and accusing each other of betrayal or incompetence and like just, you know, like the kind of thing that doesn't move you forward. But like we like NEC need to look at like what organizationally went wrong, like the politics of it all. The members chose the leader, we as a party chose, had conference, we all backed the manifesto. You take the politics aside, it's like, well, what could organizationally have we done better? Like what went wrong? Everyone knows the postal votes dropped at the wrong time. Like, what more could we do in terms of twinning, in terms of using our resources? What were the target seats? What should have they been? Like, did we do candidate selection at the right time in the right way? And some of these are decisions that we have responsibility for as well, and we need to take like ownership of. And like, well, when are we going to select candidates in the future? How should we select them? How should we allocate those resources? Like, one of the amazing things we have is our like membership base and like activists. The Tories don't have a grassroots base like that. How do we use it better in future? How do we use it more effectively? Like, we lost seats we've never lost before. Like, how are we going to win them back? And like they're often like signs as well, if you lose your MP you can lose the council later and then be out of power for a generation. Like, how do we stop that happening? So actually, like I say, like the night before I was really like not really looking forward to it. There are like meetings that are your favourite meetings that are not your favourite meetings. Like, my favourite meetings are the Equality Committee meetings and stuff, and I was not like relishing it. But actually it was really, really positive, and I think the first step of like moving us all forwards, and people I think work together really well, and we should do more stuff like those kind of smaller breakouts so we can explore what we've got in common with each other.
So with the locals in mind, this was very applicable to your role then? Because obviously it has huge implications. Whatever's kind of decided about where things went wrong, that obviously has huge implications for the local elections next year.
Yeah, totally. We have to put stuff right really quickly and like make sure that we do like have the resources in place and like select the candidates and get everything ready. Like someone was asking at an LGA meeting today, like, are next year's elections definitely going ahead, or like what are the contingency plans?
What's the consensus on that then? That it's going to be an all postal vote election, just to ensure that it does happen, because obviously they've been delayed this year, so it would be very strange, wouldn't it? And I'm not sure if it'd be unconstitutional for them to be delayed any further.
That's right. And like while this has been running, they haven't been able to be having council by-elections and stuff like that in a lot of as well. So it is very important that we're able to hold them. So we need to look at like how we can hold them. And for us, because we have such an amazing doorstep canvas operation as well, like it's difficult not being able to like knock on doors and go and talk to them. Yeah. So we need to sort of phone canvassing, we need to like get really high quality like leaflet material. What we kind of can do in a way that's like COVID secure. I mean, it's weird. Like the other day we went to the seaside and I was like, this is very nice. It's a Saturday. What do I know? Oh, I'm normally canvassing, that's why. So as nice as it is to be able to like go to the seaside sometimes, it's like, wow, yeah, we do need to be going out and talking to people. And like because we haven't been doing that as well, I think there's so much anger from the public at the terrible job the government are doing, and I think it's important for us to be like engaging with people and talking about what we do differently and what our positive vision for this country as we recover as well is. So,
and what a difficult job local government's facing as well, because it's not in the headlines, it's not glamorous, is it? It's not Brexit, and you know, glamorous is perhaps not the right words, but you know what I mean, the minutiae of local government finance and how COVID is really hitting local government is not something that's often focused on in the media, and so the public don't really know. But of course local government provides so many vital services, and now they were stretched obviously after 10 years of austerity, but they really are stretched to bursting point at the moment. I'm a social worker, and I work with people with learning disabilities and mental health, and the cost of our average package has gone up probably tenfold, because a lot of the services that we rely on, so day services or schools, are just not there. So local government is having to, and of course they have to provide a service, so local government is having to sort of meet that need, and the only way to do that is by commissioning very expensive services. So the amount of financial pressure on local government now is gone up so much, and people need to hear that you know, after 10 years that we're in a bad position after 10 years of austerity, and the government just aren't doing enough to support us.
And it's about getting the message across, isn't it? I mean, obviously we can talk about the substance till we're blue in the face about why we lost. Was it Jeremy Corbyn? Was it anti-Semitism? Was it Brexit? But obviously there's a process to be involved here as well, and it's how you get that message out that James was talking about. And I think it was Alex Sobel, wasn't it, on our first ever episode of this podcast, and we were talking to him about the practicalities of campaigning around COVID. The locals had just been postponed at that point, and that's looking like more and more that it's not going to change, is it, anytime soon, unless there's some sort of miracle in the next few months. So Alice, what would you see the NEC's role in kind of clarifying that process for members? Do you think that's going to be an easy task, or is there any plans in place already?
It's a really interesting thing, and I think after the Grenfell fire it became clear that like just a lot of people don't understand local government and how local government actually works and how important it is, and that's why it's so important to have local journalists as well.
Yeah.
And that like we had a thing that came to my LGA board that I'm on where the Tories wanted to like kind of change the law so you could scrap all local papers and you wouldn't have any statutory obligations to fund notices in local papers. But I was like, you know, as much as you don't like the scrutiny, like, well, not me, but they didn't like the scrutiny. As much as people don't like scrutiny, it's so important. And also not just in holding like people to account, but also having journalists who really understand the details of what's going on. And I think some of the best journalism about the pandemic have come from people from like regional newspapers and stuff. And like within the party as well, like there are so many different roles we need people to be involved in. Like obviously we need more councillors, but like we need more school governors, we need more people to stand from diverse backgrounds to stand to be magistrates and stuff. And there's a lot I think the Labour Party could do with our membership and kind of like showcasing all these different roles and like training and preparing people to take them up, because a lot of people join and like the thing that they see is like an MP. So people think, oh, how can I be an MP? But like actually there are like lots of really fantastic roles, dare I say better roles than being an MP as well.
When we're out of government, a lot of the roles are better roles.
I would say so. And like things that like fit in much better with a work-life balance as well. And we like it really makes a difference. You need people from all kinds of backgrounds to fill those roles. It was something we talked about at the Justice and Home Affairs one as well, like about getting more black and minority ethnic people to be magistrates.
Yeah,
and like be involved in those systems. So like I'd like to see the Labour Party doing more like kind of leading on that. But like we've got some really good training sessions if people check out the website. Like Angela Rayner has been attending them recently. We've been doing them like to kind of talk about being a councillor. Like I chaired the session for women wanting to stand to be councillors, but we've got them for my like, LGBT disability, like black and minority ethnic people as well, because like, and because we're doing it by Zoom as well, like we've been getting like 300, 400 people on the calls, which is fantastic. I know they've been doing regional beer councillor events, they've been getting hundreds of people. And like, it is quite exciting some of the stuff we're able to do because of this. Like travel and stuff isn't a barrier. Like it is much easier to like attend an hour long webinar at home than it is necessarily to spend an hour traveling to it and back.
We've actually heard a lot of that, haven't we, James? And we've been doing this kind of little mini series of podcasts. This is the fourth episode. So we've spoken to George Linders Hammond and Jermaine Jackman about diversity, because George is obviously running for the disabled representative, and Jermaine's done a lot of work with the, well, he formed the 1987 caucus and things like that with BAME and black rights. So it's strange that a party so diverse and so big already has these systemic issues or apparent systemic issues with diversity. Do you think BAME shortlists and disabled shortlists and things like that would be a good idea?
Yeah, like I totally support like all BAME shortlists. And we had that in the manifesto, and it's something that I've always been like vocal about. Like all women shortlists, it's a blunt tool, but it works. My husband like years ago wrote a Labour List article calling for all working class shortlists that cause all kinds of trouble.
How do you define working class though?
That's the issue, well, I think that's it? Yeah, that's the problem.
Based on accents, I reckon.
Yeah, well, we could stand, couldn't we, Tom?
All right, yeah.
Like, at the time, I think Labour in government, like Gloria Del Piero had like a thing about how they were going to get more working class people to stand to be civil servants, and they had a definition. We were like, oh, well, you can use those then for Parliament. But I think it was really shocking when we were doing the selections for the last election, because we did them early so people had time so members could pick their candidates. It was getting to a point, and not just the BAME representation was really bad. Embarrassing. And we were all like, you know, what's going on? And places that had like a BAME candidate imposed on them were selecting like white candidates. I think it's a point Jermaine's made lots of times, but the lack of black men in political representation, like they are very underrepresented. Not
There's
just
81 councillors, only 81 black male councillors out of 17,500. I mean, that is, it's a figure that is just leaves you with your jaw wide open, doesn't it? With your mouth wide open, sorry.
Read jaw wide open.
Whatever. You know what I mean. with your mouth wide open. It, you know, 81 out of 17,500. It's just crazy.
We had two fantastic black male councillors in Islington who didn't re-stand at the last election as well. Oh, and like, it's a problem. It's been something that like we really need to look at the kind of structures of what's going on, and like the way we run our selection meetings are different to other parties. So like if the Tories have a candidate they want, they can kind of talent spot, phone up local Conservative Association and say, pick this guy. Like, the way Labour works, you can't really do that. So it's like, well, what are the barriers then for people getting selected? And I think it's much more than just training, but like maybe the whole way we do our meetings, it favours people who are professionals, who are used to like speaking and presenting. Yeah. Like, that doesn't necessarily mean you'd be the best councillor, does it? So it'd be interesting to see if doing the selections online makes a difference as well to the people who get selected. And like, if there's other ways we should think about like how we approach everything, because it, something clearly isn't working and we're not getting the diversity we should be getting from the membership we have. And we know, like, the thing that really is frustrating with female representation is people are always like, oh, well, you know, women just don't want to stand here. We can't find any candidates. And you can't blame women or black men or whoever for not standing.
Yeah, why don't they want to stand? That's the question.
Exactly. They're in the community. They're like leaders and champions and activists everywhere. There's people who have those qualities in every part of the country. So how come we can't get any female men? Like, why can't we get black male council leaders?
It's for starters. I mean, usually when they say that, it's not true, is it? There are people that want to stand, and they're just trying to maneuver themselves or one of their allies forward. And we know how all these things work locally, but. Yeah, I mean, why are they not standing? If it's a systemic problem within the party and within wider society, probably both, it needs addressing. And obviously, I think your campaign is basically touched on, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but diversity, accessibility, and just sorting the processes out that facilitate members getting involved in local government, and then they can send that message to the electorate.
That's definitely true, and I think that's really important. That's one of the reasons why, like, I'm so proud to be on a slate with like George, Anne, and Jermaine as well. And I think that Jermaine has done like great things, like bringing this like people's minds and talking about it much more. Like, George also like has a fantastic track record as like not just as a disability activist, but also like as a role model, being a counsellor. And like, I get to vote for George because I'm dyslexic and have no lower field of vision. I didn't know it wasn't a thing. I've assumed no one had a lower field of vision. I just thought it was
That's all right.
So what? Yeah. So what's that then? That you sort of?
I just don't see anything from like here down.
For the listeners, Alice lowered her hands to below her waist.
Doesn't quite work on a podcast, does it?
But no.
Wow. Okay. That's a difficult thing to have to live with, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like walking downstairs. I'm fine going up there. Yeah.
Well, I know I had a boxing injury once for about a year and a half. So I'd fractured my eye socket, and then some of the muscle had got trapped as it healed. So for about a year and a half, if I looked to the side, my left-hand side, then the whole room was just split in two. And it was, and I crashed about three cars, the left-hand side of three cars. You know, it was a big problem. It didn't click on. It didn't sort of dawn on me until the third car. I was like, right, I keep doing the same thing. What is the problem here? It's like, well, every time you look to the left, the room's split in two. So perhaps I shouldn't have been driving.
I mean, yeah, maybe hindsight's
a great thing.
Admitted some sort of crime there, or the doctor maybe should have taken your driving license off you.
Yeah,
no one should be having their tea. I hope no one's having their tea while they're listening to this, by the way. Yeah. Absolutely horrible listening to you about your eye.
Don't box. That's the lesson to take away from it. It's self-inflicted, though.
Oh, I should say as well, like, Anne Black was always an absolutely amazing NEC member. Like, she's so working, and her reports are great. My dad likes to tell me that my reports are not as interesting as Anne's.
Oh,
they'll be out.
I'm sure they are, Alice. I'm sure they are. Yeah, we had it. She was great when we had her on. She really does know her stuff and able to articulate it very well. And the sort of person that we really support on Open Labour, because yes, she is a left winger like a lot of us, but also open to working with everybody and welcomes the fact we are a broad church as a party, and that's what we're all about. That's why we're supporting you and Jermaine and all the other candidates that we're supporting as well. So, okay, well, I think we'll finish off there then, Alice, if that's okay. If that's okay with you, Tom?
Yeah, sound.
Okay. Well, look, thank you so much for coming on, Alice. It really has been a pleasure to speak with you today. Congratulations on already being on the ballot. You have our full support. I'm sure you'll do very, very well. but to all of our listeners out there that are, I'm right in thinking they have to be a councillor to be able to nominate you, is that right?
Yes, so it's done by Labour groups, and the group secretary or leader can submit the form online, and if anyone needs the form, they can drop me an email or tweet at Alice Perry UK and I can send you a link.
There you go then, smashing. Thanks a lot, Alice.
Thank you.
So let's jump now then to our heroes and villains piece. We really enjoy this piece, don't we, Tom?
Yeah, it's an opportunity to vent. I mean, after a serious interview, it's an opportunity just to slam the Tories for a little bit. Although that's giving away our villain, actually.
Well, usually it's me that does the villains piece, isn't it, and vents. But today you get to vent whilst I get to be the cheerleader for our hero. And today our hero is going to be Ed Miliband. I realise that there are mixed opinions on Ed. However, whatever you think about Ed, his speech in the House of Commons for the debate for the internal market bill really was wonderful, and it utterly humiliated Boris Johnson. Did you watched it, presumably, Tom?
Yes, for my sins, yes. I mean, some of the backbench interventions are usually quite exciting. But yeah. Ed was just fantastic. I mean, as you'll probably come on to in a second, I mean, he's shown what maybe he didn't show when he was leader. Maybe he was held back slightly. There's different opinions on that as well, obviously, and I don't think anyone really truly knows why. But we really saw the real Ed Miliband in this, and he was really excellent.
He really was. So for context then, basically, the internal market bill would give the government the power to override key parts of their Brexit withdrawal agreement, which would actually break international law. Now, listeners will remember that the Brexit withdrawal agreement was Johnson's showpiece achievement before the general election last year. So Boris swans back from Brussels with this agreement and declares his deal an oven-ready deal, whatever that means. I mean, what a phrase, oven-ready deal. Anyway, he also says that it's great for the UK and for Northern Ireland, and also declares that it protects the Good Friday Agreement. So then he proceeds to purge his party of anybody who didn't support the agreement. And then, obviously, he calls a general election to ensure that the agreement could be passed and won by miles, which, obviously, it did. Now, Boris and Dominic Cummings have had a change of heart by the looks of it. They seem to think now that this withdrawal agreement, all singing, all dancing withdrawal agreement, is in need of a rethink. So they're trying to pass this wrecking bill. And they've given every excuse under the sun to justify using this legislation to break international law. And I'm sure that people have heard the headline reasons. So the withdrawal agreement will tear apart the UK. It'll undermine the Good Friday Agreement. And of course, allow the EU to impose a food blockade between Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, this is pretty alarmist stuff, isn't it? And it'd worry anyone if it was true. So that's the context, right? And then Ed gets up to the dispatch box during this debate, and one by one, nice and calmly, explains why everything Johnson said was absolute rubbish. And then, as a crescendo to the end of his speech, he challenges Boris Johnson to say which part of his internal market bill would stop the blockade that Johnson claims would prevent goods travelling from Great Britain into Northern Ireland. And there was a silence, wasn't there? Whilst Boris, unable to respond, just sat there with arms crossed, looking morose and totally ridiculous. And then Ed sort of launched into this attack on Boris and said, Boris didn't read the protocol, he hasn't read the bill, he doesn't know his stuff. And it was just perfect, quite frankly, because it plays into everything we know about Johnson. And more importantly, I think it plays into everything the public are starting to think about Boris Johnson. You know, he doesn't know the details. He sort of makes it up. He's flip-flopping all over the place, just sort of shooting from the hip when it comes to running the country. I mean, yeah. I don't know what you think, Tom.
No, it's incompetence, isn't it? I mean, that's the watchword, as Keir put it the other week in PMQs. Mm. But he's right, to be honest. And Ed's just completely outed Boris here. I mean, someone could have, someone with more skill than me should Photoshop a school uniform over Boris Johnson when he's sat with his arms folded. It just looks like he's getting the towing off by a teacher. It's pathetic.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be the Prime Minister in a,
I know.
A pandemic, and he's, you know, he's utterly failed. And yeah, the incompetence is just coming out week after week now. But of course, our villain this week is Boris Johnson for the exact opposite reasons that you put forward, the internal market bill. I mean, there's not much more to cover there than what you've already pointed out, James, but Ed's performance at the dispatch box has set out, you know, the real dangers of this bill. It's unthinkable that Britain could break international law. I'm not about to quote Thatcher like the EU Commission did today, but I think that would sully this podcast slightly. I'd have to resign. But how are we supposed to uphold human rights and protect historic and valuable treaties across the world without a kind of moral standing behind it?
Mm.
Everything that the British government hammers people like Russia and Crimea about, and North Korea on its human rights, has a basis in international law. And international law depends on state complicity. So if states begin to flaunt it left, right and centre, and whenever they like, then its authority is just going to be permanently and probably irrevocably undermined. It has a massive potential consequences, this, for Britain's international reputation. But it's ranging from, you know, the Good Friday Agreement and things like that, but also to enforcing things like the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons and disarmament, all sorts of things that could lead to some pretty horrific non-agreements taking place where, you know, Britain has no power to enforce agreements that have been in place since the UN Charter was kind of created in 1945. It is, as I say, unthinkable. This week, Open Labour posted a really good piece by Welsh officer Matthew Hexter and Scottish officer and co-chair Kieran O'Neill on how the bill will pose an existential threat to devolution, which is another aspect to this.
Yeah.
It seems to never end. The different aspects to this that could really damage the UK. It says that this bill would ride roughshod over the ability of the devolved parliaments to legislate in areas where it currently holds legislative competence, as well as areas in which both the Welsh and Scottish governments had requested competence post-Brexit. So it would give powers to the UK government basically to spend money in devolved areas as they see fit. And I think Kieran and Matthew put it that the UK government claims to allow them to pursue, quote, projects of national significance. You know, I mean, this could mean anything, but Kieran and Matthew go through various implications of this for Scotland and Wales, like the decision of the Labour government in Wales not to build a relief road for M4 motorway on grounds related to climate emergency. The Tories have constantly campaigned in Wales against that decision and said they basically won votes on the basis that they will build this, even though they have no power to do so. But maybe this is the way in. If this bill was passed, it would stamp out any devolved authority, which is a really dangerous game to play, especially with the threat of Scottish independence as well. It just gives the SNP more ammunition to fire, which is, you know, I'm not Scottish, so I'm reluctant to talk about this.
So I suppose a lot of the public just think that this bill is about, I suppose, the Brexit supporting public is how I should have caveated that, sorry. But a lot of the Brexit supporting public will think that this bill is just about strengthening our negotiating position with the EU. But as you've just said, it sounds like it's, I mean, I've not read into it as much as you have clearly, but it sounds like this is really dangerous because we're just surrendering more powers that have been devolved to the regions and into Scotland and to Wales back to Westminster so they can just do whatever they want, essentially, and override local democracy. Is that right, do you think?
Yeah, basically, yeah. It's basically overriding local democracy, but on a national level in Scotland and Wales. I mean, this is a long-standing agreement, the devolution agreements in Wales and Scotland that the last Labour government put in place, you know.
Mm.
So, you know, it does have potentially huge implications worldwide, but also on its own doorstep, which is scary. It does look like it's going to pass. It depends. Well, it passed its second reading the other day, obviously, by a majority of 77. There was a lot of abstentions, but we haven't got the full lists out yet, so we don't know if they were Tory abstentions. But there's been a lot of public opposition to this, even by Brexiteers. Sajid Javid was one that came out this week.
Yeah.
You know, people like that, I've been heckling the government from the backbenches, and it might face some opposition at committee stage, but again,
on third reading, apparently people were voting for it on second reading, so that because there's an amendment for the third reading that people wanted to vote for, is that right?
Yeah, so it's the amendments next week. Yeah, there might be some fireworks there, but then it may get challenged at committee stage as well. It's just, you know, it's just a numbers game really for the Tories at the moment, and if they had a majority of 10, it might be different, but because they've got a majority of 80, that's a lot of people to convince to vote against the whip. But if people would like to check out that piece by Kieran and Matthew, go to openlabour.org. It's really informative, and it really does show the importance of hearing voices from outside Westminster in relation to this bill. So if people do want to read that, then I would encourage everybody to do so.
Well, I'm going to do that, absolutely. That's great. Okay, Tom, look, thanks again for being my co-host. It's always a pleasure. And listeners, we'll see you all next time.